Well, hey everyone, this is Nate. Welcome to this week's episode of The Vinyl Guide with our special guest, Glenn Hughes of the Dead Daisies. Now, before we get into it, you may hear a little bit of a lack of energy in my voice this week. We just had a personal event in our lives, which was not great. I'm not going to go into it today before the interview, but I know many of you send me personal notes and we chat online, and some of you are interested in things that are happening in my life beyond the interviews, so I'll give a quick update after the interview. Listen all the way through the episode. It'll be at the end if you're interested in learning more. Now, about today's show, most of you will be familiar with Glenn Hughes. He's the rock vocalist of many, many bands and projects, including Deep Purple, Black Sabbath, and more. Glenn has an absolutely amazing voice and history in music. However, today we are going to be focusing on Glenn's new project, The Dead Daisies. And they've got this great new album, Holy Ground. It's an absolute ripper. I've been enjoying it for the last few weeks. However, now it's your turn. It is available on all streaming services. Dial up The Dead Daisies, Holy Ground on any streaming service, Spotify, Apple, whatever. Check it out and order a copy of Holy Ground on vinyl at thedeaddaisies.com or at any fine record retailer. And if you like The Dead Daisies, check out these other episodes of the Vinyl Guide podcast, including episode 131 with Dean Castronovo, drummer of The Dead Daisies. That's episode 131 of the Vinyl Guide. Episode 121 of the Vinyl Guide features Dave Menichetti of Y&T. Episode 123 with Phil Lewis of LA Guns. Episode 92 with Deep Purple vocalist Ian Gillan. And literally hundreds more episodes of the Vinyl Guide podcast. Available anytime for your enjoyment. Subscribe and dig through the past episodes. Now, this episode of The Vinyl Guide is brought to you by our friends at AudiophileUSA.com, the collector's record shop that sells used, excellent, and near-mint vinyl records. These are your final upgrades and holy grails, some old record stock that hasn't been touched in decades. AudiophileUSA.com has a way of just finding these boxes that have been stored for decades, some records still in original shrink wrap from decades past. And AudiophileUSA.com ships worldwide. So go there now, AudiophileUSA.com, sign up for their newsletter and get first dibs on all newly acquired stock. That's AudiophileUSA.com. And we're also brought to you today by the Groove Washer, the world's greatest record cleaner. I use the Groove Washer daily, and that is all I trust my records to. I have no idea what kind of bathtub gin those no-name brands concoct, but I'll be damned if it's going on my records. I use the Groove Washer, formulated specifically for vinyl records and used by the experts. Head over to groovewasher.com, use promo code VINYLGUIDE10, and save 10% off on all Groove Washer goods. Ask for the Groove Washer by name at your local record shop or go to groovewasher.com. That's groovewasher.com, discount code VINYLGUIDE10. And with the upfronts done, let's talk to the legend himself, Mr. Glenn Hughes of the Dead Daisies. This week on The Vinyl Guide, we have with us the frontman of the Dead Daisies and a longtime rock and roll legend, Mr. Glenn Hughes. How are you today, Glenn?
I'm doing good. How are you, yourself?
I'm doing good. Well, look, Glenn, the Dead Daisies, the new album, Holy Ground, is out January 22nd. By the time this interview airs, everyone will be able to pull it up on their streaming services, check it out, play it loud, and of course, purchase the vinyl copies that are available at thedeaddaisies.com. And I got tons of questions about how it was written, how it came together, what you guys are doing during COVID, all that. But first off, when the Dead Daisies called, who called you? Where did that call come in?
I got a call from management, David Edwards, mm-hmm. from Sydney. He called me in late February of 2019. I had a rumor from one of my bandmates that David was looking for me, and we organized a phone call, and we had a lovely conversation, actually four or five conversations, to get to know one another. And he asked me if I'd like to meet with David Lowe, who lives in New York. And we arranged, David flew out to see me, and we had dinner at the Sunset Marquee in Hollywood. And David asked me if I'd like to get together and how would I feel about joining the band, because I've been a solo artist for so long, you know. And I said, you know, I don't have a problem with being in a band or whatever. It's just I got to be friends with everybody. I'm an only child and I want to be part of the kin, you know, the brotherhood. Mm-hmm. That was important to me. I've known Doug for quite a long time, and Doug was in my band 5 years ago. So for me to be in the Daces, Nate, I had to become part of the fiber of the band and be a brother. And I felt that immediately when we got together in August of 2019 in Sunset Sound in Hollywood.
And at that point, you were enjoying a solo career. I know you were touring around the world. Now joining a band. What was the conversation in your head about moving from solo artist to, again, being part of a band?
Great. This is great for Australia, actually, because in 2017, in September, I didn't stop as a solo artist, but I put together Glenn Hughes Presents Classic Deep Purple Live, and the opening tour was in Australia, and it was such a success. And what happened after that, Nate, we went around the world a couple of times, and 2.5 years later, around, early 19, I get the call about. And to be honest with you, Nate, it was good for me to switch gears a little bit. And look, I've been in Deep Purple a long time ago, and 2.5 years of doing that show was a long time. And I wasn't looking to do anything else other than maybe go back to doing another album, solo artist. You know, I get offers all the time to work with people. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, I get a call from David Edwards, and, you know, and I started to think about, am I ready to do this? It's a challenge for me again to give my love and support to a band I'm going to be in. And the most important thing for me, Nate, was songs. Without the right songs, you can't get to the next level. Mm. And David Lowe wanted me to bring my songs with me. So the day after I met him, I wrote this song called Holy Ground. And when I met with the band a few months later, I played 4 or 5 songs to them. The first one would be Holy Ground on the acoustic guitar. They had played me some demos with all instruments, and I played them my songs on the acoustic because I love the way that sounds. If you can play good on the acoustic, it's going to win, I guess. And I was hoping it was maybe the right thing. And we all sort of decided, well, let's make a demo of this song. And as we're making the demo, I realized, you know, this is the right thing for me to do. And hopefully it's the right thing for the band to do.
So as you were coming together, writing that music, each of you were making eye contact and noticing that those sparks were there.
They were there. And again, good question, because eye contact is important to me. Again, the only child syndrome, I'm always like looking for that camaraderie is huge with me. And if you see any like new video clips of us in the studio, you can see there's a lot of camaraderie in the band. Very, very important, because it leaves a good trail behind us. So the brotherhood for me is very, very important. And how did we survive a whole year, basically, without seeing one another? Yes, I saw David once in October. I've been with Doug quite a bit this year because we're quite close to one another. And so for us not to be able to be together and be pals and then play, it's been really difficult. But we've hung in there with the fans, and here we are with Holy Ground now coming out.
Now, let's talk about recording the album. This was recorded prior to COVID or just at the very beginning?
It was recorded November, December of 2019. There was no trail or glimpse or rumor from Trump or anyone else about the Wuhan connection. Again, if you or the listeners would like to view the lyrics I wrote, there's going to be people going, are you sure you didn't know about this? I'm tongue in cheek right now, because I do write about the human condition, about love and faith and fear and no fear and letting go of attachments and being present. That's what I write about. I don't write about anything like fictional goblins down the garden stuff.
Yeah.
So I'm sure that these lyrics will touch base with people that are spiritually inclined, especially the letting go aspect of the music, about it's okay to move on, people. It don't stay where you are, because yesterday is gone and tomorrow is not here. It's a big thing for me to live in this present moment. And the songs you've heard already, without the, you know, the other stuff you haven't heard yet, you've heard it, but not many people have. It's all about letting go of attachments.
So let's go track by the album. Because you're right, I've heard the album, I think it's phenomenal, and I'm pretty sure my neighbors are getting used to it right now, too.
Okay.
What song on the album means the most to you?
Well, they all do, Nate. We wrote a bunch of songs. I wrote a bunch of songs, and three or four didn't get used, which was good, because they didn't quite fit. And we were very honest with each other and with our producer about what was going to work and what wasn't going to work.
So which one sticks out as most poignant, though?
Wow. They're all, okay. Let's just say this. We did the first, there was two sessions at La Fabrique in Saint-Rémy in France. We had the November sessions. I had a tour to do. I was in Russia, and then I did a UK tour of Glenn Hughes Performs Classic Deep Purple Live. And then I took a break to go to Paris to meet the guys in Saint-Rémy, and we recorded 8 or 9 songs. Then I went back to Paris after the tour, and right before I got on the plane on December the 1st to do the second session, the night in my hotel room in Birmingham, I wrote a song called Far Away. I was going to suggest to the guys, maybe, you know, we could maybe try this. It's a slower song. It's got a heavy middle section. It's long. It's epic. Great crescendo at the end, orchestrated. It's got the soft blend voice, and it's got the turbo voice. And I don't think the Daisies have ever had a song like that before. And when I played it to Doug, first of all, he was thoroughly excited by it. So I called David and Dean to come up to my room, and we all sat around, and I played the song to them. And, you know, I wasn't trying to promote the song to them to do. This band does what they need to do. But I think everybody felt that this song was different. And it was also a rock track with very significant spiritual lyrics about coming home. And I always do write about the sea in my work, about I'm at sea, I'm lost at sea, but I'm going to come back one day. And here we are, and I'm telling people that, you know, I want people to catch the soul and heal the pain, and love remains. And I thought, wouldn't this be a great song? And maybe, just maybe, wouldn't this be a great way to close the album?
So everyone was on board. Obviously, the song Far Away is the album closer.
It is. And again, Nate, I can talk about every track. I've got other tracks that I love, but you asked me, I told you what. And, for me, because it was a song that hadn't been written yet, I had an idea. Maybe the guys would like it. You know, if we hadn't recorded, it would have been okay. I would have just kept it for myself some other time. But the song itself was pretty much autobiographical, what I was going through. In the winter of 2019. I've got a great family life, a great missus in LA and everything, and I was missing being home. And but it's a beautiful piece of music.
I agree. Do you suffer from writer's block at all? You've been at this quite some time now. Are you pretty confident that when you get involved in a project, the songs will come even if they're not there?
Another good question. Okay, let's take it like this. In the 70s in Purple, if you want to read the lyrics from anything that David and I wrote, they were very sort of very young man lyrics, you know, not being disrespectful, but it was very simple. And as the older you become, my dear friend Robert Plant tells the same story when he wrote Stairway to Heaven. it's a different world when you become older and wiser, if I may say so. So for me, let's just say before 1991, I don't remember the 80s, by the way, at all. I was a different songwriter before then. I had success as a songwriter, but I was told in early sobriety by a few people I know that I would become a better person, number one. I would become a better musician and better songwriter. And I said, oh, that can't be possible. I've done everything. And by sort of the mid-90s, I made a couple of records by that point. I'm going, wait a minute. I'm not singing about girls and sex and, you know, I'm singing about life. I'm singing about recovery. I'm singing about helping other people. I'm singing about, you know, I'm just being of service. And I changed the way I wrote because my life had changed drastically. And I've never changed. I've always written about the spiritual condition and people helping one another and to heal the pain of the whole world and to put your headphones on at night before you go to bed and you'll find yourself in the music that you're listening to.
So you allow yourself to just open up and to receive whatever the universe is going to provide in terms of those lyrics. You have the confidence to go into a project. And if you don't have something ready or you haven't written with these people before, you know that something will come.
Another great question. About 20, 25 years ago, I was in a writing session with a couple of famous other guys, you know, and it was like sitting around a computer for hours and hours and hours. And it was like so stressful because you got these guys who are all famous and stuff and everybody's trying to write. And it was so damn stressful. And I went home and after 10 minutes, I had a song already done. Not saying I don't like to write in a room with people, but I've had a lot more gratification being alone. Like, for instance, when I work with Joe Bonamassa in Black Country, I bring a song to him that's almost done and he'll do the same to me. And then we'll get together that way. And same way with Doug. And for me, to be in a room writing in a session, it doesn't work for me. As I like to be somewhat, I like to be alone to come up with an idea. My head's a dangerous place to be sometimes. So I've got to be sort of in my room, in my studio, you know, with an acoustic guitar or electric guitar, and I come up with an idea and I bring it to people to say, hey, you know, shall I finish this song? You want to help? Let's see what we can do this, you know. So
when you joined the Dead Daisies for Holy Ground, what were the state of the songs? How many songs were there? I'm assuming that some were already in existence and you came in and wrote lyrics, or were you starting from ground zero?
Ground zero. So, and Nate, these are some great questions. We haven't had this stuff before. So the first day at Sunset Sound was, let's call it pre-production listening day. David and Dean had some ideas that was full demos with bass, drums, and guitar. Mm-hmm. I don't think there was any vocals on there. And they played me their material. And then I played them mine on the acoustic guitar. And there's only a couple of songs that we've actually finished from. One would be Like No Other that Doug sort of came up with, and I finished it. Maybe it was Bustle and Flow, and I finished that with Doug when we got to France. And the rest of it, I did come up with five songs that were on the album that were musically kind of there. You know, I had titles, but no lyrics. And then we find ourselves at La Fabrique sitting in a room and coming up with a brand new song called Come Alive, which spoke volumes to me. And we pieced all these songs together. We trusted one another. And we have a great producer, Ben, who really helped.
Ben Gross, he's worked on some magnificent projects. Is this the first time you worked with Ben?
Yes, I love Ben Dealey. He's a good man.
So what's his secret? A lot of albums I hear that sound really, really good, his name is somewhere in the liner notes.
Well, he's old school. And by the way, I like old school. Mm-hmm. I'm not really a fan of the 80s, just to be clear. But
mm-hmm. Well, you don't remember him.
So for me, Ben's old school. And because I normally produce my own work. And working with Ben at La Fabrique was brand new. I met him at his place in Burbank. And we're down there, you know, I was the last one to arrive in France, and I was late at night, and we had a soft drink together. And the next morning, there we are. I can't remember what song we started with, but it was pressed the green button. And we recorded live, by the way, Nate. If people want to know how do we record, we don't go the Pro Tools, you know, drums first and then put the bass on the guitar. No. Deep Purple and Led Zeppelin didn't do it that way, and I was damned if the Dead Daisies should do that. So we, for me, being in a large room with a high ceiling for great effects, you know, with a microphone for me to sort of chirp into, we basically got a song done every day, and that's the way we did it.
Yeah, you got to capture that energy, everyone playing together.
Well, you know, with the song... the idea that Doug came up with this idea of the intro for like no other. We hadn't got a title for it. And we went in to cut the song. Again, the microphone is on. And it's driven by the bass, that song. And we come up with an arrangement. Doug and I came up with the arrangement. And we're playing it. And I hadn't got a lyric. I had a title like no other, but I kept singing, "You're like no other. Can you feel my bass line?" I kept singing it and singing. I'm going, wait a minute. I went in the control room and Ben said, "You know, that really is a good hook line." And I said to myself, "Can I actually say that?" And apparently we kept it. So for me, that's a classic example of being spontaneous and not being in fear of what you're writing and allowing yourself to be in a position to do just that.
Now, can you connect with lyrics that you didn't write?
Whoa. Taking a drink of water. Not really. Mm-hmm. Unless it's a classic. I mean, I re-recorded Nights in White Satin for a movie with John Frusciante and Chad Smith about 15 years ago. Written by my friend Justin Hayward. Now, you see, when you're singing a song like that, it's easy because those lyrics are so bloody good. But I find singing other lyrics that other people wrote, you know, not really what I want to do. Do I do it? Well, yeah, I'll do it. But do I feel comfortable? I make myself comfortable. Mm-hmm. You know, I make myself comfortable. I never shy away from anything.
But I would imagine you're kind of going through the motions with that, as opposed to lyrics that you wrote that you know where they came from,
right?
They mean a lot more.
If you're viewing me singing it live, you'll never know if I am going through the motions, because it's not who I am. I didn't write I did write lyrics on the Burn song, but I didn't write the major of it. But I sing that song every damn night, you know, and it still works for me. I also sing Mistreated, which I didn't write. Mm-hmm. So if I'm going to sing something, Nate, that somebody else wrote lyrically, if you see me singing it, I got to believe it, you know, and the guys in the band know that, you know. So, but again, it's really about giving it back to the audience and the band itself believing in what they're doing is the appropriate thing.
Now, you've only played a handful of shows with the Dead Daisies up to now. Is that right?
No shows at all yet.
No. Oh, okay. All right. Like, obviously, it's just, you know, there's a lot of questions around the world about just about everything. But knowing what you know now, are there going to be some shows in 2021?
Well, Nate, I have to be very careful here. I don't know if you know, our team in Sydney. We had a tour scheduled to start in Germany, February the 3rd. That's just been canceled or postponed. And that would run till late March. And then, you know, there was other stuff going on in Europe, and then maybe there was some stuff in the Far East. But then again, Nate, everybody understands if we can't be there. But what we don't want to do is string people along saying we're going to be there and then we don't show up.
Right.
So what we're trying to do is to do this appropriately, because everybody understands we're going through this all together. Our desire and dream is to come and play Australia amidst many, many, many countries. I know it's on the books. I know it's penciled in. And I actually did say to David Edwards, if I'm going to join the band, we got to play Australia. So,
You've obviously talked about what that live set would look like. Obviously chock full of Dead Daisy songs. What other surprises could people potentially expect from a Dead Daisy
show? Well, what we're going to do, again, everybody that has made an album, the answer they're going to say is we're going to promote the new album. a selection of songs, a lot of songs from the new album will be played. And a selection of older songs from the Daisies will be played. We've rehearsed a few of them. And there's going to be, I would imagine, there'll be a couple of songs from Purple I will bring in that will sound great with the band. And it will give the band some strong foundation for rock fans as well. So there you have it. Basically, new songs, some older Daisy songs, a couple of covers. And we got a wham bam, thank you, ma'am show.
Let's say, again, touring continues to be delayed. Will there be further recordings from the Dead Daisies, you think?
I would imagine so. Mm-hmm. I've been writing, I say this stupidly, like a crazy man. I write all the damn time. I have a selection of songs that have been written, and let's see where we go from there.
So in a situation where you're not being able to be with the other members, are there other demos and things floating around between the four of you about other potential songs? I mean, you're still working together. It's just now everyone's remote. Yeah,
I have. I'm being very careful here. I have demos. Yes, I do.
Okay. Since this is the vinyl guide, I got to ask you, do you have a record collection?
You know, honestly, I do not. This may freak people out, but I have never in my life, except when I was a teenager, when in trapeze, never collected records. I've never really bought any albums. I've always been gifted them. Only because I'm so, I don't know, man. It's like, I get it. I know where you're going with this, but I can't lie to you. I just don't have any record collection, you know? So I write so much music and I do enjoy listening to some music, but I'm really not a music aficionado of listening to other people's music. You know, I like the Beatles and stuff like that. And, you know, as far as generally, I don't have a big remembrance of a lot of music.
That's all right. What were the records that started you out in terms of listening to music when you were young? What were the records that you had as a kid?
Beatles, all Beatles. The first, you know, the first three albums, and then they did Sgt. Pepper, you know. And that, for me, was the opening of my musical window. And the Beatles are, for anyone in my age group or anyone a little younger, even younger than that, we have to, you know, say that the Beatles, in my opinion, are the greatest musical band that's ever existed.
When you were listening to the Beatles, I mean, the albums were coming out real time through your youth. Through the evolution of the Beatles, for example, Sgt. Pepper at the time was such a left turn in terms of music and the whole package of the album. What was that like receiving that change from the band?
Well, I was at school and that was an album I did buy. I think I was 14 or 15 at the time. And for me, I wasn't writing songs in my mid-teens, but I was playing music at school, you know. But when I heard the entire album as a young lad, it shifted everything for me because the songs were so amazing, very well arranged. The lyrics were incredibly good, both by John and Paul. And I love George, by the way, and Ringo. It's just those albums for me were the honing of what I consider to be the start of my musical life.
And so that is what inspired you to pursue a career in music then, yeah?
Yeah, I mean, I started playing trombone in the school orchestra. I was named after a very famous trombone player from World War II named Glenn Miller. Mm. My mom and dad were big fans of his. They named me after a trombone player. So I played trombone in the school orchestra when I was 12. And by the time I got to 13 and a half, 14, I saw the Beatles on TV, and then I switched to playing a more sexy instrument like a guitar.
You noticed none of them were playing a trombone.
No.
All of a sudden, we fast forward a couple of years. Finders Keepers. Is that the first time you personally were on a vinyl record?
That would be the first time, yeah. I mean, that was a long time ago. And by the way, in those times in the late 60s or mid 60s, a lot of bands were using session players to play, actually play. You know, in fact, on Finders Keepers, those two records I did, we didn't actually play on those songs. We actually sang on, you know, but back in those times in England, I don't know what was going on in Australia, but I think it may have been the same. They had studio guys, you know, Decca, where we were, playing all the instruments.
Well, yeah, that was prevalent throughout the industry. You had that mob out of L.A., the Wrecking Crew. They played on just about anything that was on the radio or on record.
Oh, those guys were so good.
Okay, so you didn't play a note of bass on that, even though you're credited to it, but you did sing.
No, I didn't. I mean, again, what I won't do with you, Nate, or with anyone else, I never. It may cause some people to ask questions about me, but I never do lie. When someone asks me a question, I'm going to tell them the truth without masking it too much. But no, not a lot of bands, unless you were established like The Who or The Kinks. You know, if you were, you know, coming into town as young lads, they had studio musicians.
Were you a bass player at that point?
I was just started. I was playing guitar up until 1968. And then I joined Finders Keepers because the bass player left. And on Thursday, I got a call to play with them on a Friday. I had to learn everything again on the bass guitar, which was interesting.
And that's been interesting because throughout your career, there's always been those phone calls that say, Glenn, we need you in the band.
You know, been very blessed in the way that, and crazy story. I've always been the youngest guy in every band I've been in. Well, David was a little bit younger than me, actually. But with Trapeze, especially, and Finders Keepers, my beginnings of these bands, you know, a lot of my friends in these bands have gone. They passed away. And here am I doing still, you know, 50 years later, over 50 years, doing what I'm intended to do as a child.
Listening to this new album, Holy Ground, what really struck me right off was your voice. I mean, phenomenal for, I won't reveal your age, but let's also say throughout your life, you've not always been entirely kind to your body.
No.
How do you account for your voice still sounding as strong as it does today?
You know, okay, let's touch on that. I didn't tug on my mother's apron as a child to become, hey, mom, when I grow up, I want to be a drinker. I want to do drugs. It just things happen in life where, you know, you get led astray, if you will. And I did. And I recovered in 1991. Mm-hmm. I look back at the dark periods of my life, and it made me so much stronger as a man today. So very fortunate to have survived that ridicule. But I've always taken care of my voice. I may have not have taken care of other things in my life, but I've been very athletic with my vocal ability and the chords. And my, I treat my vocal cords with kid gloves. I exercise with my vocals. I'm an athletic kind of guy. I'm a vegan. I am in no fear of singing. Whereas I'm a real big soccer fanatic, football, you know? Mm-hmm. And I know some big time players, and they talk about, you know, when they're going to take a free kick or shoot a penalty, if they think they're not going to get that moment, they're going to miss it. So when I'm singing, either in the studio or live, I'm always very, very in the moment and very sort of, it's all going to be okay, Glenn. I never think it's not going to be okay. But for me, the biggest thing for me is my breathing technique. I've got large lungs, apparently, so I've got a way of holding the notes longer. If you look at any footage of me on video, you might notice that I don't strain. Yes, I have that 5-octave range, and that's great, but I don't really push it. And that's it. You know, I've learned from other great singers that they do the same.
Is there like certain rituals that you have to do with your voice in terms of warming up, or certain teas you drink? How do you treat those precious vocal cords?
Good question. You think a lot of people would ask me that, but they don't. So here's what I've been doing. About 15 years ago, I went to see a vocal coach, and I got the recordings. And then my friend Joe Elliott from Def Leppard gave me his recordings from his teacher, that I started to study that, you know, when Kings of Chaos, when Joe and I sang in Kings of Chaos with Matt Slash and Duff, and we would warm our voices up for about an hour backstage. And then about 5 or 6 years ago, I changed everything by doing a rather, I'd say, 2 or 3 songs big time at soundcheck, 2 or 3, a minimum of 2, sometimes 3, sometimes 4, to warm my voice up in the live scenario when I'm on stage doing that. So that's worked for me, actually warming my voice up at the venue, on stage, then leaving the stage, having a bite to eat, then going into a room and warming it up a little bit more. With no tape anymore. I just sing.
So just exercise. Practice makes perfect.
Exercise. And again, Nate, you probably interviewed a lot of singers. I am so grateful to have been given this gift. And for 5 decades of doing this. And they, you've seen me in Australia. I mean, I love playing there. And I am very much, if I can say to you, a very much a live singer. I love making the records, let's be clear. And by the way, I do sing live in the studio playing the bass. Some of the things you've heard on Holy Ground are actually live with playing the bass.
Wow.
So for me, Nate, I live and breathe being clean and sober / live singing.
Mm-hmm. At what point in your life did you realize, oh my God, I do have this gift? When did it dawn on you that your voice was specially crafted more than others?
Wow. So I've been singing for about between 69 and 72. I'd been singing, first of all, I was the second singer in trapeze on the first album. And then this album's number 2 and 3, Medusa and You Are the Music. By the time I'd done You Are the Music, people were talking about that voice that we know, especially in the UK. Well, in America too, actually. But I didn't know. I was just showing up and singing. I was just writing songs, showing up and singing, thoroughly enjoying myself. But other people were talking about the voice, you know. So, and you know, when I joined Deep Purple in 73 and David and I sang on Burn together as a duo, that's when a lot of people said, well, is that Glenn or David singing those lines? And I'm going, well, it's both of us, you know. So I've always been a fly on the wall looking back at my career going, well, you know, that was good. That was okay. But the most important thing for me, Nate, is being in the moment when I'm singing. You know, to be complimented is okay. I mean, it's okay. But it's like I don't really listen to much compliments. Mm-hmm. I just really love being myself in the moment and singing live. It's incredible feeling.
All right, Glenn, thank you so much for joining us here on The Vinyl Guide. And again, I got to highly recommend everyone check out the Dead Daisies' new album, Holy Ground. It's available now. Go to your streaming services, Apple, Spotify, whatever. Check it out. Play it loud. It is phenomenal. And then pick up a vinyl copy. Of course, you can go over to thedeaddaisies.com. There's links to where anywhere you are in the world, there's a store that will ship you a copy of the Dead Daisies Holy Ground on vinyl. And again, Glenn, thank you so much for joining us here on The Vinyl Guide.
You're very welcome. It's my pleasure to be talking to you. And again, I say to you all in Australia, can't wait to see you again.
All right, there we go. Mr. Glenn Hughes of the Dead Daisies. And you can hear what all the fuss is about. This album, Holy Ground, is now on all streaming services, Spotify, Apple, wherever you get your streaming music. Check it out, Holy Ground, and you could always pick up a vinyl copy at thedeaddaisies.com. All right, I'm going to spend a few minutes talking about something I mentioned at the top of the show. We had a personal tragedy in our family this week. My godfather, my uncle Robert Flores, passed away. My Uncle Bob, a very strong guy, but unfortunately COVID caught him in December, and he spent the last few weeks really just struggling for his life before finally losing that battle on Friday night.
Now, my Uncle Bob was a huge figure in my life, a really good guy, one of those salt-of-the-earth fellas who just liked helping people and always looked after his family. You know, when we were kids, he was always around, but he wasn't like this uncle. He was always wanting to hang out and do things with us and participate. He wouldn't stand on the side and just kind of let us do our thing. He'd want to be there. He'd want to hang out. That was important to him. And he was such a good guy. You know, he'd always put family's needs ahead of any kind of selfish things he would have. I don't think he was selfish at all, in fact. Whenever we'd fly into Los Angeles, which was really once or twice a year up until 2020, Uncle Bob would meet us at the airport. He'd look after us. You know, sometimes he'd feed us if we were hungry. Yeah, he'd see us on our way. He'd sometimes drive, you know, hours across Los Angeles traffic just to have a lunch with us, just to say hi, just to, you know, he'd do that kind of thing, you know. Whenever we go to record fairs, you know, we'd be there at like 6 a.m. He'd come around midday, which is kind of, you know, halftime for us, and bring some snacks, grab us a coffee. You know, he was always happy to just help out. You know, even my friends who were heading down to L.A. to meet me for whatever shenanigans we get up to, Uncle Bob would open up his house, let them stay at his house when I wasn't even there, just so they could get down early and meet me the next day. So he'd open up his spare room to my friends, which is pretty damn great, you know. He looked after us to the point that he looked after the people who were important to us, and that is incredibly unique. My Uncle Bob was just a great man, and I certainly look to him as an example of the sort of person I want to be like. Short of my father, he was perhaps my greatest role model. He lived a good life, left behind a wonderful wife and family, and he will very much be missed. So he's one of those humans that we need more of, and unfortunately there's one less of him now on the planet. Anyway, Godspeed, Uncle Bob. We love you very much, and me and Mary and the boys, we hope one day our paths will cross again. All right, well, that is it for this episode of The Vinyl Guide. I'm not going to elongate this anymore, except to say, everyone be safe, be well, wear a mask, look after one another, do what Uncle Bob would have done. Okay? Everyone be cool, be safe, and we'll be back with a brand new episode shortly. All right, cheers, everyone.